to The Divine Breadcrumb with your hosts, Carol Campos and Deb Sorensen. Carol and Deb have always believed the universe helps people on their path by sending signs, clues, or what they call divine breadcrumbs. A divine breadcrumb can create both small and massive shifts in a person's life. On this podcast, Carol and Deb will speak with authors, healers, entrepreneurs, and other amazing people across the globe to discuss these pivotal moments. So get ready to learn, to love, and to laugh. And remember, the universe always provides if you allow it to. Enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Carol, co-host of The Divine Breadcrumb. I am so excited to talk to you about my new 10-week one-on-one coaching program, Energy, Esteem, and Empowerment. I designed this program for people who feel powerless, who feel like their self-worth has been damaged and continually attract toxic situations and people into their lives, but can't figure out why. And worse, they feel like they can't be who they really are. This is something I've been called to do for a long time based on my own experiences with trauma and abuse and my long journey to heal. In this program, we'll be focusing on uncovering your personal power, cultivating self-esteem and self-love, and doing deep energy work. It's time to remove the mask and let your true voice be heard. To learn more, go to carollcampos.com, click on the services tab, and then private coaching. Again, that's carollcampos.com, click on the services tab, and then private coaching. You can do this, and I'll be right there with you. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Divine Breadcrumb. I'm Carol.
This is Deb. Yes, welcome back.
So Deb and I have long joked that we don't know a lot about wine, but we know what we like. And when we traveled the coast of California in 2017, we sampled many of the local wines and did a tour of Napa Valley and Sonoma and, you know, visited some of the wineries there. And what we found is that just because you're in wine country doesn't necessarily mean you're going to like what you taste. And we needed to learn more. So we thought, why not change that? Today's guest is wine and beer sommelier Rob Statham. Rob hails from Canada and is the owner of The Drunken Grape, which was founded in 2015 and aims to educate and spread awareness of wine, spirits, and beer. And what separates Rob from other experts is that when he's showcasing a wine or beer, he can tell you about it in the context of what was happening in history at the time it was being made. It's a true education. Before founding The Drunken Grape, Rob's past experience included entertainment and hospitality management experience on luxury cruise lines. Much of his time was spent initially as cruise staff for Norwegian Cruise Lines and then as either an art auctioneer or assistant entertainment and or assistant cruise director. And this experience helped Rob in his media presentations for beer, wine, and spirits. And now Rob is working on video branding for Ontario wineries and breweries. And I've been following Rob's work for a while now and have learned so much from watching his YouTube channel. He's the real deal, and we're excited to learn about what he's got going on and, of course, which wines and beers are his picks for this summer. So, Rob, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. I've been wanting to do this for a while. So you started your career on big cruise lines. What made you decide to learn more about wine and beer and ultimately start The Drunken Grape?
Well, it actually goes back to growing up, really. I think I've always been around it. My late father was a pretty prolific wine and beer maker. He used to make it for his own consumption and for his friends. So, you know, I grew up with him doing that, usually on Saturdays or Sundays. He was a military officer and it was a side hobby of his and something he really loved. So we roll along years later. I'm at a crossroads. This is going back 8.5, 9 years ago now. And I was over at his house visiting and I was talking about what to do next. I had a business that had broken down with a partner that had substance abuse problems with alcohol. And it was in the IT business, it was in the IT world. It was something very foreign because most of my life had been spent in hospitality. And I was looking for change from that. And I was thinking of project management because for the 5 years that I was involved in IT, I was looking at something that I was using regularly already. So I was looking into just study project management. I came over and I was sitting down at his house and he looked at me and he said, you know, that's not really going to be you. I mean, I'm looking at your past background. He goes, if I were to redo everything, I would have gotten into the wine and beer world professionally. So I started to think about it and started to make more sense. So at work, I asked a couple friends about what they know of wine, and one directed me towards what's called the WSET, or kind of the godfather or godparent of wine education out of London, England, called the Wine Spirits Education Trust. So I enrolled in one of their courses and I just fell in love with it. I honestly, at the time, I knew nothing about wine, and it really, really piqued some interest. And one of the things that really hit me pretty hard was the fact that it's so rooted in history. And along with a history and poli sci degree and a minor in business, it all tied into what I'd studied and what I was already pretty passionate about.
Oh, I love that. I think it's interesting, you know, that you had that moment in IT, because obviously that's Deb's background. And yeah, going from that to what you're doing now, it seems like such a huge leap, but everything unfolds the way it's supposed to.
Yeah, I mean, it was something I tried out. I did enjoy IT at times. I think I was on the staffing and consulting end, and I worked with a high-end solutions team in infrastructure, architecture, you know, data center design and disaster recovery and IT security. And it was something that never really resonated fully with me. I mean, the money was good. The environment was interesting. But I found much more of a home coming back into this part of the world, into hospitality and ultimately into the wine and beer fields.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And I know tiny, tiny little bit, Carol had mentioned that we toured the wineries on the going up the coast to California. And it's fascinating to hear some of these stories. Most of our listeners are women. And Carol mentioned, after having a conversation with you, that women have played quite a role in the wine and beer industry. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, historically speaking, especially beer, women have been really prolific. If you take a look at it, you go back all the way in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, where in Mesopotamia, which was really what they document as the starts of beer, and with its main ingredient, barley, water, and yeast, the time they didn't have hops. You can debate whether it was founded in China, but women had a huge hand in it. It was believed it was also discovered by a woman. Hmm. And the Babylonians had a goddess dedicated to brewing called Nekenshi, which that they actually prayed to. And it was deemed as a cooking activity. So you also got to remember, throughout most of our history leading up to the 20th century, water was not safe to drink.
Right.
You could get killed drinking water, all the microbes in it. So the act of beer is brewing, and in the brewing, there's a boiling aspect, of course, and it would purify it. So what would happen is they would create usually what would almost seem like these low alcohol level porridges, but it was there to nourish and hydrate the family at the same time. I mean, this was one of the things that they did. If you go into the Middle Ages, often men were at war or conscripted to go to war, and the women would be left to toil the land. And one of the things they did to generate revenue is they often added to or built a tavern on the farm. Mm. And then they would have like a bed and breakfast, and they would brew, and they would sell what they would brew to the travelers passing through. So it's quite fascinating. And as far as the world of wine, I mean, some of the most prolific figures in modern wine history are women like Madame Veuve Clicquot from House Clicquot, the Champagne house. And she had such a huge impact on Champagne. She was the first one to really develop a very clear, I don't know if it was a clear style, but it was yes, she was the first one to develop a very clear style of Champagne through riddling. It's a process when you're coming to the completion of Champagne itself, is that you take out the yeast, the dead yeast cells out of the wine as part of the process. So you clarify it. And she was one of the ones that developed that. And she was also one of the first ones to develop a dryer style champagne. And these are things that were just incredible, as well as to really exercise global trade.
Wow.
So there's some prolific figures, female figures, definitely in the wine and beer world.
That's really cool.
I know, it's really interesting. And these are things when I'm watching your videos, Rob, I love that, because I always pick up information that I had no idea about. And it's good for people to know. It, you know, when you're eating things, drinking things, it's good to know the history.
Well, and it's a lot of things that are missed. I mean, you can get too deep into it too. A lot of people really just care about the flavor profile, what the food's going to pair with.
Exactly.
What's a great wine for celebration? You know, I've got friends coming over. I want a light lager. Do you have any good recommendations for a light lager that I can have on tap or a bottle or a can? These are typically the things that go through people's heads.
Yeah.
And the forgotten part, and you're right, in a lot of cases, is this is shrouded in history all the way back to the beginning of civilization. I mean, there's books written about, for instance, about how beer saved the world. And a lot of it has to do with the water supply and a food supply, because to cultivate grains, you had to build a civilization around it or an infrastructure around it. It's quite incredible. And from there, trade. I mean, wine and beer are historically really deeply tied into global trade, financially speaking, too.
Right.
Right.
And I think if you talk to the average person, at least in the United States, pretty much all they are really aware of is prohibition.
Yeah.
And that's really as far as their knowledge of historical right. knowledge of alcohol goes.
Yeah. A big dark period for the world of alcohol, but it didn't really succeed. But made a lot of families very rich up in Canada, particularly the Brofman family that owned Seagram's, because they just bootlegged alcohol across the border.
Yeah.
A lot of the things, for instance, Canada had some interesting laws in prohibition where you couldn't sell regionally or locally, but there was nothing to stop you from selling internationally. And this is how they skirted the law and didn't get busted by their own government selling into the United States. It was actually perfectly legal, even though it was illegal for Americans to purchase it there.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned in the intro, you've started working on video branding for Ontario wineries and breweries, which I think is a really cool thing. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I've been working on video for years as a side shoot, talking and branding Ontario and Ontario wines and beers, like craft breweries, craft wineries. I've been showcasing them on television for quite a while. And, you know, in good economic times or leading up to what happened with the quarantine and COVID, they were reluctant in a lot of cases on the video side of things. You know, they wanted to either put a 25-year-old that knew nothing much about beer and wine in charge of it as a social media director. I'm sure you've encountered this before yourselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just didn't want to pay. Now, as soon as the pandemic hit, panic just shot through the whole industry because in some cases, a lot of these wineries and breweries rely on up to, in some cases, a huge portion of their business. Could be 75 up to 95% for some of them on premise. So that's restaurants, golf courses, bars, hotels. And that all got scuttled. And we have no idea when that's going to come back. So it has, the interest of it has definitely taken off. In fact, I just finished some professional work for an excellent brewer here called Flora Hall Brewing in Ottawa, one of the best. It's like a brew pub that they actually just brew their own beer and they sell out of their own operation. They own the whole building. So it's quite clever by the owner, David Longbottom. He's a retired, very successful tech guy, and he put it together. And they've been proactive. And they're selling out all their batches all the time. So what they've done is they kept a scalable operation that, in case of natural disasters like this, because this is really what this is, they were able to survive and thrive. So a lot of the wineries are coming on board, and I really want to focus on the local side, because in order to regenerate our economy, and it'll be the same for you in Massachusetts, you're going to want to focus local for quite a while to help everybody recover. And it's the only way to go, because it's the foundation of the house.
Right. Yeah. So true. And it is alarming to see how quickly businesses failed just because nobody's planned for anything like this.
No. And the other issue too is brick and mortar. I really feel for friends in the restaurant business.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a business I'd ever sink my teeth into, just because, you know, years ago I looked at that and I'm like, wow, there's so many things I can't control. And the profit margins are terrible. I mean, in the end, you're looking at 4, 6, 7%, and that's before taxes. So you're thinking about it and you're like, wow, somebody in order to, on average, if they were to clear $1 million a year, would have to have, in some cases, up to $25 million in revenue coming through the restaurant. We know the bulk of them don't even come close to that. And the hard part was with all the taxes and fees, particularly here in Canada, it's a bit excessively taxed on small storefront businesses and regulated. There was no savings in place. So, I mean, they're scrambling. We're here in Ottawa now. I'm already starting to see some places fail, some places getting boarded up. And I have a feeling when everything reopens in the next 3 weeks or so, we're going to walk outside and there'll be about 50, 60% of the businesses just no longer there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Scary.
It is. And, you know, that's going to limit choice. That's going to limit options. There's a lot of things we know that just don't go well with that socially and systemically. But one of the things I'm just really trying to do and help is just trying to bring that positive light and aspect through the videos to highlight what they have, the wineries and breweries. And it has definitely helped them with their online sales because they've all had online sales. But the other part here is they get to rely on government-run liquor stores and the grocery stores as well. The grocery stores aren't government-run, but we have the Liquor Control Board of Ontario here, which is a prohibition-era organization. But the good part of that is in cases like this, there's a centralized house that's a buffer for them, so they still have some revenue coming through.
Oh,
yeah, that's great.
But they have very little focus on their websites and very little focus on online ordering. It's almost like people are aware that the winery offers it, but they're not aware because nobody really emphasizes it.
Right, right. And I was going to say, that's why, you know, because I've seen some of the videos, and these are, for the listeners, these are really high-end videos. This is not somebody took out their phone and you know, videos. This is really nice videos that showcase the wineries in a very high-level way.
And it's important, yeah, because it's really important. You know, people have the look, touch, and feel with their senses. And video, we know, is a very, very powerful medium if done right. If it's directed and coordinated and there's a focus to what you're doing and the message can get across clearly to the viewer, it's probably the most powerful way to go.
Yeah, I agree. And not everybody can get to a winery, you know, so it's kind of interesting to see what it's all about and seeing the different rooms and hearing you talk about the different wines. It's really a little mini documentary.
Well, kind of. I mean, that's interesting. It's kind of like the idea of it all. I sort of think of ancient cities of the underworld. I mean, there's a show on, I don't know if you had it in the States, but there was a show.
Yeah, we did.
Which is really cool. The guy goes into like the underbelly of Prague and he says, here's the city below the city and the substructure. And like the city under the city is like twice the size. And
You're
just blown away and fascinated by it. Well, I kind of feel the same way when I uncover a lot of these wineries because they also have amazing stories. I mean, whether it was dedicated to a lover and they named it Cassoday, like House of the Goddess here in Prince Edward County, they're a great winery. You know, there's others where the family just decided to purchase a plot of land and generations later, it's still within the family and it's expanded from the 6-acre little plot to hundreds of acres. And it's an industrial powerhouse. It's just, it's incredible where things have gone. I mean, even if you look at beer, if you go all the way back with Guinness, I mean, what launched Guinness into being a powerhouse in the history? A lot of people aren't aware of these facts, and even the major global players, is they signed a land deal. Arthur Guinness signed a land deal for £45 a year. I believe it was in 1757. My dates might be slightly off there, but for £45 a year, he signed a deal for 9,000 years.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
The greatest real estate deal signed in history. If you put that in the numbers, it's like paying what, $57, $58 US a month for this massive site.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, near St. James Gate. So you're just like, wow, this is just in Ireland. This is just incredible.
Yeah. So to our listeners, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Listen to Rob's YouTube channel because you get so much of this. And this is my favorite part of your videos.
Well, thank you. And, you know, the other part too is I would like to make it fun. I kind of call it edutainment.
Yeah.
One of my good friends is an MW or a master of wine, and she lives out of LA and she's terrific. Her name's Jennifer Simonati Bryan. And one of the things she stresses is on the video side is she's like, Rob, I had to learn to scale things down because you got to entertain the client too. I mean, you got to entertain the person, even if it's a student learning about courses. And she's developed this way, and I really believe in this philosophy too. You take high level information and you make it simple and ready to understand, and just focus on a couple key points and takeaways, because it's a fine line between having a lot of fun, as you two know, as professional presenters as well. It's a fine line between having fun and then going overboard and the audience starts to fall asleep on the other end. That's the last thing you ever want.
Exactly. And you've definitely found that perfect balance.
Well, and I, you know, there's some fortunate aspects to that too. I grew up with a father who was a public speaker. And then I got into the entertainment side of things, and a lot of those skills from the cruise line industry definitely transferred over, whether you were emceeing shows, you were giving a lecture on a port coming up or whatnot. In my case of art, you're spending 2 hours on a microphone talking about the history of the art, the pieces, if it's sports memorabilia, the background of the teams, the individual before bidding it away. So you get familiar with the semantics of going live.
Yeah, so all that served you well.
It really did. I feel very blessed and grateful. It's kind of neat that everything sort of converged into this field.
Exactly.
Yeah. So a selfish question for Carol and I, although I'm sure this will be of interest to our listeners too. We're at the unofficial start of summer. So what are some of your top beer and wine picks for the summer? And what would you pair them with?
That's a great question. I think any type of rosé is very effective in summertime. I mean, the traditional rosés in Europe really come out of places like Tavel, which are known for it. It's an appellation in the Rhone Valley that's dedicated specifically to rosé, or anything from Provence or Languedoc and Roussillon, the southern part of France. These wines almost seem seasonal in the sense that they pop up around May, have availability to September. Here in Canada and throughout the rest of the world, we've mimicked a lot of what they've done. And in that style, of course, it's just food friendly. And I mean, you can get into semi-dry or off-dry styles as well with hints of sweetness. Goes great with a lot of things. And you can have, think of salmon or trout on the barbecue because the rosé will just pair well with it. It tends to complement and cut into it. The acidity cuts into the fattiness of the fish. It tends to go really well there. Beer styles, one of the ones I always have fun with is a Hefeweizen. It's a German beer, and it means half wheat. And it's got a lot of fruity fennels to it. So you get banana, clove, bubblegum flavors come up. It goes really well in the heat of the summer, I find. You can pair that with things like pork. You know, you can also range into even an easy drinking style, you know, Pinot Grigio, Radlers, which is almost like a light lager juice infused, a shandy. It was created in 1922 for cyclists in Munich. That style, just because it's thirst quenching. So, you know, anything that tends to cleanse or cut the palate just tends to cleanse the palate, or it's thirst quenching, tends to go really, really well at this time of year.
Oh, good. Now we have some good recommendations.
Yes, we'll have to try some new things.
Yeah. Well, I've already started with rosé, so that's been actually really good because I was always kind of a Pinot Grigio girl in the summer, and so this is good, trying something new.
Yeah, it's neat because, you know, Pinot Grigio, unless done right, can be kind of light. It can almost seem like acidic lemon water when you're drinking it, unless the style's done well. Whereas with rosé, you know, you can get a bottle, I'm not sure what they retail for in the States. Your wine prices tend to be a little lower on the economy end. And that's sort of where a lot of the rosé styles float in. I mean, they're all under $20. You can end up usually getting a great bottle for $14.95, $15.95. And it's notes like if you get into the richer styles where the grapes have soaked longer on its skins, or it's fermented longer, you'll get a richer, darker style. So you get notes like strawberry and cherry popping up in it. And it's, just very pleasant.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because that around the 14, 15 mark, that's pretty average for here. And what Deb and I have noticed is so many times when we've tried the more expensive wines, we didn't like them. So you can't really go by price.
No, you can't. In a lot of cases, price is just more indicative of production. So, you know, if it's a small plot where a lot of high-end wines come from, or specific sites or appellations, where it's usually around small towns, slopes of hills, it's just harder to work the land as well, because particularly on slopes, you can't machine harvest these grapes. So you got to hand pick them. And then of course there's the cost of, ferment it in large temperature controlled stainless steel tanks or concrete vats. These are common for inexpensive wine, but the minute you start to barrel wine, I mean, just to purchase these from the cooperage sites where they make oak barrels, it's expensive, especially if you start delving into European oak. It gets very costly. So that's what pushes the price of wine up, also with supply and demand, but it doesn't necessarily indicate whether that wine's going to be good or not. I mean, there's a million things that go into viticulture. One of them, the hardest thing, is to measure what's going to happen year to year with the growing season.
Right.
Is it going to be rainy? Is it going to be sun? Do we have ample sunlight? Some of these regions of the world, there's a huge difference year to year between, I mean, you can have a boom year one year and the bust year the next year, and they're only a year apart.
Exactly. Exactly. What about, so Pinot Noir is one of our favorites more in the winter. Do you have any recommendations on that?
Well, you're in the States. I would definitely be diving into anything from Oregon or Willamette Valley.
Yeah.
I find that they just have the best. I mean, you can Russian River Valley around Sonoma. These are some good regions for Pinot Noir too, out of California. A little less expensive than Oregon on average, but I think when you get into the specific quality marker, Oregon wipes the floor with everyone in North America, and for the most part, with Pinot Noir. They've done an exceptional job in that specific region, or what Americans call an AVA, or American Viticultural Area, that covers that whole geographical space that grows vines for the production of wine.
Yeah, we did discover that on a trip.
Yeah, so we were on the right track. Yay, okay.
Yeah.
So, Rob, you're very big on giving back, which is just a wonderful thing. Tell our listeners how you're giving back right now.
Well, there's a lot of ways. Even on the individual end, you get messages all the time. People ask, you know, how did you do this? How do you do that? How would you recommend developing a brand? Or how would you recommend marketing this idea? Or just people in the starts of business, or people that are actually in the throes of it, that are stuck on certain problems. And I find you always have an opportunity where when that door opens, you can either just walk away or put your hand out. I like to put my hand out, pull people up. And I think it just, giving back is crucial. Like, I think about even the wineries and the breweries. One of the things that I've done to pitch the whole idea of to get onto videos, I said, listen, just send me some product. I'm not asking for money, but I need the product as the tools to be here. And that's just common sense.
Right.
And listen, I'll feature you two or three different times on video to see whether you like the flow of this or it's working or not. You know, and there's no pressure there. And I believe these elements of giving back and genuinely giving back, not with a set strategy in mind to try to squeeze people, because that's wrong. I think it has a very good causal effect on the overall wellness and positivity of your life. I think things come, and it's funny because things come out of it. I know a good friend of ours, Carol's met him before too, Scotty Schindler. He talks about, it's important. In the beginning, when he was building up, I believe he had a software company of real estate, and it ties into my philosophy, is he gave back quite a bit to the clients before, in some cases, before he even got any kind of deal or contract from them. And it's important to establish that trust too, because people see that you're genuine and that you care for others. They're going to tend to want to, especially in today's age, it's becoming ever more important with the younger generations. They want to see that type of goodwill before they even engage and do business with you.
Yeah. Actually, two thoughts while you were talking. One, of course, yes, that just that relationship is so important. I had a realtor that I ended up working with, and long before I was ready to put the property on the market, he was local to the area. So I had emailed him and asked him a couple questions. And basically his attitude was, you have any questions, you just let me know and I'll help you out. And I mean, to the point where he visited the property, he did all kinds of things years before he ever got the contract to for the sale.
It's funny because that legwork is so crucial. It makes me think of even recently with the video we did for Flora Hall Brewing. I mean, I walked in, I didn't come in and say, hey, you know, I'm good friends with the owner, he knows me well, I'm here to pick up some beer, and then make a phone call and try to grab some beer. I went in, did a site visit, walked around, examined, how are we going to showcase this and make it and really go well beyond the value add that he's looking for? You know, and you just walk in, and it reminds me of just that strategy. And I walked in and I talked to his customer service rep at the counter, because the restaurant's closed, but they have a window where you can order all kinds of beer. And I ordered some beer and left and thanked her. And I could see why he has such a successful business. And it's kind of cool that your realtor did that, because I can completely see the logic in the thinking. And he definitely had a plan for the future. And he didn't care about today. It was what he or she, and they were just looking at what could be done potentially down the road.
Yeah. And my second thought about all of that, one of the things that I find with giving back is that it reminds you that you have something to give. So therefore, you have things to be grateful for.
You know, that's very, very true. That's very powerful. And it is absolutely true, because it is a blessing when people are also coming to you for help.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I think that's something that's missed. A lot of people tend to take that in a power position and not a position where they can actually affect serious positive change. If I think of some of the best mentors in my life, they're the ones that were able to pivot like that.
I think a lot of people are just sort of stuck in that whole competitive vibe.
Yeah.
They don't want to share. And I think maybe we've all been there. I don't know. But if you can sort of reach out and you just bring everybody with you, you know, everybody rises.
Well, and I think it really stems right into your education system, our education systems. You know, there's this scarcity mindset, even in economics. I remember taking it first year university. They talk about the supply curve and scarcity. And you're always drilled with scarcity. You know, if you don't go to school, you're not going to have a good job. If you don't get that degree, you're not going to have a business. And, you know, it's BS. It's like all this stuff is crap. It's the furthest thing from the truth. When you have an abundance mindset, things come from the heart.
Absolutely.
More from positive thinking. They come from a thinking where you're calm and you're no longer emotional. You can detach yourself from it when you think with abundance. When you think of scarcity, the security blanket comes on, you panic. And unfortunately, so much of society has been taught scarcity thinking. I think I had to unlearn it, and I'm pretty sure both of you did, and anybody who's come across on the other end, unless you had a parent that was really switched on, and usually somebody that was very successful at something, you probably grew up with a scarcity mindset. And that's probably one of the hardest things for people to break. And I'm proud
it is.
Broken it. And I'm glad to help others break it too.
Yeah. And we feel the same way. I mean, we often say, you know, there is no pie, you know, you don't have to worry about getting your piece. There's plenty for everyone. And just doing this show, that's kind of our little gift to the world. It's a way to showcase great people doing all these amazing things. We don't have ad revenue. It's just something we like to do. It's fun and getting good news out there, which I think is also needed.
It is. And it's something at least I'm very blessed. I'm very grateful to be in the field I am, because I think of wine and beer and I think of joy. And somebody asks me why I'm involved in it, and I said, because it's happiness. It's joy.
Oh, we agree.
I show up somewhere and people, it's funny, you know, there's always the talk of, hey, what do you do for a living? And hey, so many people are just so overly focused on what you actually do, but not who you are. So, you know, you're sitting down at these networking events or a private party and you've got the accountant and you have the lawyer and they could have some big businesses going on. And people are like, yeah, that's just typical about you. Hey, what about you? And I look at them and said, well, you know, I work in the wine and beer field. I just don't go really into depth at first.
Yeah.
And they go, really? So what do you do? Are you sommelier? What part of it are you in? The whole conversation changes. And there's like, my wife loves Prosecco or whatever it is. Like, start talking about, you know, you have any good picks for me? And it's almost like you walked in and the whole room does a 180 on what you do for a living. It's like if you were a pro athlete or something else that's cool, you know, an actor or whatnot coming in, they react the same way. It's just, you know, and if you show up to somebody's door and they're miserable and you're going to visit a friend, I mean, when I come over with some beer or wine for them, the first thing they do is you can just see the stress lift off their face and they smile.
Oh, yeah. It's funny because my mom's in her 70s. I know she doesn't listen to the podcast. It's not her thing, you know, but when I told her that I was talking to you, she was like, oh, really?
That's awesome. Yeah. So I think that's the biggest part of it. And because my lifestyle or livelihood comes from a position of bringing about joy, it's an easier pivot for me as well to come through with that abundance mindset, because it's already partly ingrained when you're thinking of from a position of happiness.
Yes.
Well said. Yes,
I love absolutely that. Absolutely true. So Rob, what else do you have going on that you can share with our audience?
Well, it's just a lot of things business-wise. It's been a particularly challenging year for me. You know, I lost a couple very key family members over a 10-month period. And I can say, well, they no pride happens, but I can say to people, I mean, and this holds true for the times we're in. If you're having a bad day now, things will get better. You know, you do have to work on it and just harness the hope and harness positive energy that you can take one step at a time to improve things. And I mean, and I speak about this literally, and it does fuel me. I mean, I lost my twin sister to cancer, and then my mother just recently passed from a long battle with dementia. They're two closest women in my life. Fortunately, I've got my second mom and my stepmother alive. She's awesome. And other sisters, and then the family's good. We're close. But it's in these moments where you have a choice. And I know with the darkness that's hitting the world right now, and especially in the States with the riots going on due to the, you know, the racial violence and the murder, and so many people have been impacted. But the key is to harness hope and to harness a direction from that and get out of the ashes and fly. And we all can.
Yes.
Beautifully put. And what a note to end on. Rob, thank you so much for spending some time with us and sharing your wisdom and your stories. It's really been a fun time.
I love this. Thank you very much, Deb and Carol. This has been great. This has been absolutely a treat to be on this podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much. Our pleasure. Rob, where can people find you online?
Well, I've got my website at The Drunken Grape, www.thedrunkengrape.com. That's getting revamped because it's about 3 or 4 years old now. We all know that websites need to be revamped from time to time, but it's there. That's always the permanent structure. And then on social media, they can find me directly on LinkedIn. You know, just key in my name, Rob Statham. You're going to probably find some guy holding a bottle of wine and a glass in a photo, which is true. Then, of course, there's Facebook. I have my Facebook page, The Drunken Grape. So those are really the main spots that I'm involved in, and the YouTube channel. And I always tell people, make sure to subscribe if they want to hear some cool things about wine and beer, and to get some good advice about some upcoming products.
Terrific. And we will include all of those in our show notes as well, so people can find you.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much again. I think this is such a fun episode, and it was just such a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, Deb, thank you. And thank you, Carol.
Absolutely.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. As always, you can catch the show on the divinebreadcrumb.com, Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. We'd love to hear from you. If there's any subject you want us to cover or anything that you think would make a great show, or if you know anybody that would make a great guest, get in touch and let us know. You can get in touch with us through the website right on the contact page. Thanks everybody for listening, and we will see you next time.
Hi everyone. If you love the Divine Breadcrumb podcast and the stories we're sharing, please consider supporting the show by making a donation on our Buy Me a Coffee page. You can set up monthly donations or make a one-time donation in any amount you choose. Just go to thedivinebreadcrumb.com and click on the Support TDB tab. Or you can go to buymeacoffee.com/TDB. Again, that's buymeacoffee.com/TDB. We're forever grateful for your support.